Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. We're going to be in chapter 4 and 5 today. I'm having to break into a literary context because really chapter 4 through the beginning of chapter 7 is one unit, but it's just too long to cover in one lesson. So I'm going to cover 4 and 5 today and 6 and 7 next time. Let's look, if we could. This is part of the fulfillment of the judgment of God announced in chapter 2 and 3 on the house of Eli and the sanctuary at Shiloh. Now, many, many commentaries would say the very first phrase of chapter 4 should go with chapter 3. Thus, the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now, there's two possibilities there. Either that means that Samuel is the person that called all of Israel to war with the Philistines, or that this first phrase should go with chapter 3 and start with, "Now Israel went out to meet the Philistines." It's interesting to me that the Septuagint starts this with, "And now the Philistine gathered themselves against Israel to go to war." It puts the impetus on the Philistines and not on Israel. Those are the two options. Now Israel went out to meet the Philistines. The Philistines are part of the sea peoples. They're a group of folks from the Aegean Islands. They tried to invade Egypt around 1200 B.C., some say about 1175. They were the only uncircumcised people in this whole area. They landed on the southern Palestinian coast and formed five major cities there. They were the first ones to have iron implements, and so they had superior technology. They were a mercenary people, and they kind of took on the culture of which peoples they lived with. They assimilated the Canaanite culture. They took on the Canaanite gods. They took on the Canaanite things. We know very little about them, really, as far as their background. They infiltrated the Jews not through military conquest, but through economic unity and ties. And that's what Samson was all about, to try to break that into hostility so the Jews could see what was happening. Now, notice, if you would, where it says, in battle, encamped beside Ebenezer, that means stone of help, that's where the Jews were, and the Philistines camped at Aphek, and that means fortress. When the Philistines drew up in battle array to meet Israel, then the battle spread. Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 of the men on the battlefield. Now, this word for thousands, some of the numbers in the Old Testament seem very large. And it seems that the word for thousand can mean several different things. It can mean a clan, a tribal clan, or it can mean a military unit. It doesn't have to mean the literal thousand. And so sometimes we take it literally, and it should not be, we make it larger than it is. I'm not sure exactly what it should be here. The people came into the camp. The elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today?" Now, that was a good question, because God was in charge of the victories. But they got the wrong answer before the Philistines. Let us take to ourselves from Shiloh the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, that it may come among us and deliver us from the power of our enemies. Wrong answer. This is kind of a magical view of the Ark of the Covenant. Now, it's interesting to me that both aspects of the Ark are mentioned here. Some see this chapters 4 and 5 as kind of an independent Ark narrative because Samuel kind of falls out. But I think Eli is here. I think it does explain the low ebb of people magically looking at the Ark instead of relationally trusting in God. The fact that it's the Ark of the Covenant meant that it's a chest that contains the 10 words of Moses and other things of that period. So it shows the covenant between Yahweh and the people. And the word "it" here is literally the masculine "he." And some say that God may dwell among us. You might well see Numbers chapter 10, verse 35, where it seemed that God was in their midst. This Ark of the Covenant was the footstool on which God's feet dwelt. He lived in heaven, but it was his footstool. You might want to see 1 Chronicles 28:2. And so here we have the Ark both as a representative of the covenant and a representative of the presence of God. Now, this idea of the presence of God is seen quite often in many passages, but I want to hold it till I get to verse 4 with the cherubim. Notice what it says in verse 4, "And the people went sent to Shiloh, and they carried the Ark of the Covenant." They carried it. That's what they're supposed to. Remember, later on, one of David's men is going to be killed because he touches the Ark when it was in an ox cart. It never should have been put in an ox cart. It was meant to be carried. You go back to Numbers 4:15, Deuteronomy 10:8, Joshua 3:6, Joshua 6:6. It was supposed to be carried by Levites. "Who sits above the cherubim." And the word "sits" could be the word "enthroned." He is enthroned between the cherubim. It was a symbol of his presence. Before they crossed the Jordan River, it was the Shekinah cloud. After that, it was the Ark of the Covenant. Now we'll see Exodus 25:22 and 2 Samuel 6:2, Psalms 80, verse 1, and Psalms 99, verse 1. Now, who are these cherubim? Well, cherubim, any I-M in Hebrew, is plural. A cherub is the singular. It's the angel, an angelic order, we first encounter in Genesis chapter 3, verse 24, that once Adam and Eve were expelled from the garden, a cherub guarded it. A cherub with a two-edged sword guarded it from them coming back in. We also see that in the description of how to build the ark in Exodus 25:18 through 22, it was to be two cherubs with their wings that met. We also learned that on the curtains of the tabernacle were pictures of cherubs. Now, cherubs sometimes have four faces, sometimes two faces. Sometimes they have four wings, sometimes six wings. And Ezekiel's going to see them in Ezekiel chapter 1 and verse 10. Now, that's where it mentions, and the two sons of Eli, Phinehas and Hophni, were with the Ark of the Covenant. They went with the Ark. And it happened, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, and all Israel shouted with a great shout. This must have been something like a war cry. We see remnants of this in other parts of the Old Testament. Joshua chapter 6, verses 5 and 20. Judges 7:20. And maybe most aptly in this context, 1 Samuel 17:20 and 52. This loud war cry. When the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What does this noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews?" Now, the word Hebrews is very interesting. We think it goes back to the great-grandson of Shem. Eber, E-B-E-R. And you might want to see Exodus. Well, before you do that, you might want to see Genesis chapter 10, verse 21, and Genesis 14, 13. Some believe that this is what non-Jews or non-Israelites call them. And that kind of fits, because in Exodus chapter 1, verse 15, and Exodus chapter 2, verse 6, that's what the Egyptians call the Hebrews. There's been a much discussion among commentators how the word Hebrew relates to the Akkadian word Habiru, H-A-B-I-R-U, which seemed to be a group of nomadic Semites that were moving during this second millennium B.C. period from place to place. And to tell you the truth, we're just not sure of the relationship between Hebrew and Habiru, the ones who cross over. We're not sure. The Philistines were afraid. Look at verse 7 and 8. It's interesting, in verse 8 they say, "For the hand of these many gods." Now, why would they say many gods? Knowing the uniqueness of Israel was one and only one God. Well, it may be from the word Elohim that they used to call God, which is really gods. Or it may be from the fact that they were polytheist and they assumed that Israel had many gods. We're just not sure there. Notice where it says, "the gods who smote the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness." Now, of course, the Septuagint adds plagues and in the wilderness, which shows the problem here. The plagues weren't in the wilderness. Were the Philistines just quoting false information, or has the word "and" dropped out? We're just not sure. And then verse 9, it says, "Take courage, men. Let's don't be slaves of these Jews. Let's fight for it." And they overcome the Jews the next day. Even with the Ark of the Covenant, they're overcome, because the Ark of the Covenant was not some magical charm that would win the battle. Look at verse 10, where it says, "Every man fled to his own tent, and there was a great slaughter." This little phrase, "every man fled to his own tent," is an Israelite idiom for "I'm going home for good. I quit this. I'm not fighting anymore." You might want to see 2 Samuel chapter 20, verse 1, and 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 16, where it's used in connection with the kingdom splitting in 922 between Jeroboam the first, the Ephraimic labor leader, and Rehoboam, Solomon's son. Now, beginning in verse 12 and following, down through 18, we have somebody comes and tells Eli what has happened. It's mentioned a man from Benjamin, a professional runner apparently, because it's over a 20-mile run. We know in this time they had no telegraph or telephones. They had professional runners who could run these long distances, and that was their chore. They stood ready beside military people and kings. Now, why mention it was a Benjamite? Well, the rabbis say that this was Saul, the next king, at a young age. That's possible. It's unusual for the Old Testament to add that kind of detail, and yet it does here. His clothes were torn. There was dust on his head. Of course, these are two of the signs of mourning. They would tear their robe in the front about 6 inches down. If it was a woman, she would turn it backwards. Then they would sew it back up, because they're frugal people, and that way if you want to tear it again, you wouldn't mess up two robes. Now, Eli was sitting on his seat by the road, verse 13. Now, the etymology of these Hebrew words is somewhat in dispute. Are we talking about on top of the gate, which is some translations, or is he sitting on this very special seat? Now, we saw earlier in 1 Samuel this special seat in the court that the person sat on. I think it's this thing, maybe a raised seat with no back, for he could judge the people. I think he was at Shiloh. And I think he fell off backwards because there's no back. When he heard, his heart was trembling for the ark of the Lord. Now, this shows his faith. He was worried about his sons, but he was more worried about the ark of the Lord. He should have been that way earlier, and he wouldn't have got this judgment to come on him. Now, he hears about it, and it mentions down in verse 18 that he was very old and heavy. I think the text is trying to give you a reason for why, when he fell off the back of his seat, he broke his neck. His bones were brittle, he was very heavy, and it killed him. And then in the verse 18 it says, he judged Israel 40 years. Now, the Greek translation of the Old Testament says 20 years. But the truth is, we're listing Eli the same way we listed the judges. He is seen as a judge here, and how long he brought peace to the Israelites. Now, notice in verse 19, when his daughter-in-law heard about that, the wife of Phinehas, that she was pregnant to the point of giving birth, this trauma caused her to go into labor. Notice in verse 19 it says she knelt down. In this part of the world, in this age, these women used what is known as a birthing stone. It was a raised stone. They would grab a hold of it, squat down, and have the child on a flat stone that had been cleaned off. And that's what she attempts to do. We see that several other times in the Bible about kneeling down to have a child. And here's another example of that. The baby comes, but she's weakened in childbirth, either through the trauma of her husband dying or because she realized that the ark was gone and Israel had lost the battle. She even names her boy. The midwives say, "You've got a son." And she says, "Name him Ichabod," which means the glory has departed from Israel, or in glory. We're not sure exactly what it means, but she recognized that this was a tremendously important thing that had happened in this battle, and they had lost the Ark of the Covenant, the central symbol that unified the tribes during this period of a loose tribal confederacy. It was the very heart of their covenant faith, and they had lost it. Apparently, not because God was less powerful, but because he was rejecting the magical use of some implement instead of trusting in him personally. And then she died in childbirth. Now, chapter 5 is a continuation of this same account, and it shows what happened when the Philistines got the ark into their possession. Now, the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. And when the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. Now, Dagon is an interesting a name for a deity in the ancient Near East. We found in some texts that it goes clear back to the 3rd millennium B.C., in Mesopotamia, the Fertile Crescent. And there, it seems to be a fertility god, particularly related to the word for grain. And Dagon is very close in Hebrew for the word for grain. There are other places that we think it comes from the Hebrew word that meant rain clouds, or therefore the storm god, i.e. another name for the fertility worship, the god that caused the rains, and therefore caused the fertility. But from the Rosh Shamra text, we have found that Dagon is either the brother or the son of the high god of the Canaanite pantheon called El, and that Dagon is the father of Baal, who is the male fertility god. And so I think that's very interesting. Now, two Jewish commentators of the Middle Ages, Rashi and Kimchi, say this word comes from the word for fish, and therefore is the fish god. But I think of all these, the grain god, a fertility god, is probably the best. Now, when the Ashdodites rose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. It's the picture of Dagon worshiping Yahweh. Now, the ark was put in this temple to show that Dagon had defeated Yahweh. That was the whole purpose of putting in this national temple. That was what they thought. The national gods fought as well as the people, and the one who won, the god, was stronger. But this is a symbolic act that Dagon is subservient to Yahweh. Well, that kind of embarrassed them, so they picked him back up and put him back on his little pedestal. And when, verse 4, and they arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face before the ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both of his palms of his hands were cut off on the threshold, and only the trunk of Dagon was left. This time when it fell, it broke apart. Now, apparently, his hands and head were either broken at or fell upon the threshold. Now, why is that so significant? Well, look down at verse 4, cut off on the threshold, and look at verse 5 about, nor all who enter Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. Now, the threshold has always been a very holy, sacred, mysterious, superstitious place in the temples of the ancient Near East. It was the place where the secular life divided to the sacred life. It was believed to be inhabited by spirits. Here, it seems that something of the power of this threshold was where Dagon's arms and head were broken right there. And so something in memory of this, it either says that they walked on the threshold, meaning they walked on it on purpose because that's where Dagon fell, or going back to Zephaniah 1:9, where it says they leaped over the threshold, they were afraid to walk on it, is the meaning of this text. We learn from Roman tradition that the threshold was very sacred, and the Romans did not walk on it. That's why even the thing about carrying a new bride over the threshold goes back to this pagan practice of being afraid of the threshold. We see something of that superstition here, though we're not exactly sure how it relates. The little phrase, to this day, shows the presence of a later editor. It shows that we're writing this account much later than the time it happened. Beginning in verse 6. Now the hand of the Lord was heavy on the Ashdodites. Now, the hand of the Lord is a play on the hands of Dagon cut off, but the hand of the Lord is powerful. It's also of highly symbolic use to talk about God as if he has a body. We know this by the term in Greek for man, anthropos, and so we call it an anthropomorphism, morphe-like, man-like. We're talking about God as if he were a man. God does not have a body. God does not have a hand. But we're speaking about a metaphor of God's power. Usually it's the right hand that's usually spoken of as power, and this is the idea here. And he ravaged them and smote them. Now, my New American Standard has hemorrhoids. I want to talk through this because some have, King James has hemorrhoids, which is kind of a form of hemorrhoids. Let's talk through this. This is the Hebrew word ophelim, which means a heel or a swelling. And some think the heel or swelling means some kind of tumor or swelling. When the Jews read this text, the Masoretic scholars who put the vowel points in an ancient consonantal text only, repointed this in such a way to make it another Hebrew word. They turned it into the Hebrew word P-E-H-O-R-I-M-I-N, which refers to the swelling around the rectum caused by a very bad case of diarrhea. We learned this is what Josephus, in his book, The Antiquities of the Jews, book 6, chapter 1, verse 1, says it was dysentery. But the other word for a raised or swelling, some believe, because this is connected with mice in chapter 6, verses 4 and 11, and the Septuagint even puts mice into this text right here in chapter 5, that maybe we have something like the bubonic plague. The lymph nodes under the arms and around the groins, when they're infected, turn dark and swell, and many think that's what it is. If it relates to the idea of dysentery, then hemorrhoids is appropriate. If it relates to the idea of swelling in other parts of the body, and probably because of connecting with the rats, we know this disease of bubonic plague comes from the fleas on rats and mice, then maybe that's a better interpretation, but we're just not sure. But I want to tell you, it was the miseries, folks, for these people. Now, it's interesting to me that the Septuagint brings the mice in early, but it seems in chapter 6 that they should be in early because they make golden hemorrhoids and golden mice to put beside the ark to send it back as a kind of appeasement offering to the Lord. So I'm assuming that may really should be here also. Now, let me go a little further in, when it says, and when the men of Ashdod saw that it was so, they said, the ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is severe on us and on Dagon our God. Now, the people of Ashdod were trying to figure out what was the cause and effect here, and they attributed this plague, as well as the destruction of their idol, to the presence of the Ark of the Covenant. So they had a meeting in verse 8, and they sent and gathered all the lords of the Philistines. Now, we know about all these lords of the Philistines. There are five major cities along the southern Palestinian coast that were the stronghold of the Philistines: Ashdod, Ekron, Gath, Ashkelon, and Gaza. And apparently they're structured like the Greek city-states. And that shows, that, of course, that these Philistines were the Aegean people, the people of the sea. They brought their government with them, but they took the religion of the Canaanites. And so they had a meeting of these five kings, we might say, city kings. And some of them said, well, we're not sure the Ark of the Covenant caused this. Send the Ark to another city and let's see before we send it back. And so they sent it to another city, and the same thing happened at that city, at Gath. And it came about, they brought it around, and they brought it to another city, and the same thing happened to that city. So they sent it to Ekron, and it happened to that city. They're getting the idea that they're in big trouble because of what they've done to the Lord, and so that they're going to try to make some compensations for that. They sent, therefore, and gathered all the lords of Ephesus, and said, "Send away the ark of the God of Israel, and let it return to its own place, that it may not kill us and our people." Now, it seems that several things were happening here. Number one, they recognize that their God has been humiliated. They are also recognizing that three things seem to have happened. Number one, there was this plague of some kind of bodily swelling. The Septuagint adds that there were mice, that there was mice everywhere. The Septuagint even seems to imply that the mice came from ships. Now, it's not real clear in the Greek if the mice came from the ships or the mice go on the ships. Matter of fact, the New English Bible even says they were infested with rats, which changes mice to the larger form of those animals, the rats. I'm not exactly sure here, but they're attributing the bodily disease, the presence of rats, and one more thing. God seemed to throw a divine confusion on them. They did not know what to do. They were concerned. They couldn't make a decision. They were frightened. They were upset. And this confusion is also part of the plague that the Lord caused because his ark, which symbolized the covenant that he had with the people of Israel. And it's mentioned here in verse 11. There was deadly confusion throughout the city, for the hand of the Lord was very heavy there. And when the men who did not die were smitten with hemorrhoids, and the cry of their city went up to heaven. Now, up to heaven implies not just that it was a very loud cry, but even possibly that their cry went up to God. When this same thing is used in the story of Jonah, their cry went up to heaven. It's the idea of God repented of what he was going to do to the Ninevites. And so here's the idea of God seeing that these people are trying to turn away from desecrating his cultic emblem anymore. And we're going to study in chapter 6 and 7 how they send it back and what happens. I think there are some very interesting things here in this chapter. We see that the judgment of God is going to fall by means of the Philistines. And yet, as always happened, God is going to use the Assyrians, God's going to use the Babylonians, God used the Egyptians earlier to judge his people, to try to bring them to him, to try to discipline them for their waywardness. And yet, even those that he uses to judge his people, he also judges them. And so here we have the Philistines serving God's purpose of apparently destroying the priesthood and the shrine at Shiloh. And most scholars would say around 1050, Shiloh was completely destroyed. The tabernacle, all the remnants of that destroyed. And apparently in this very same moment that the ark was captured, for the ark does not have cannot go back to Shiloh. It has to go to another city in Jerusalem in Judea, which implies that Shiloh was fully destroyed. Now, God's going to use these uncircumcised pagan polytheists to serve his purpose. I mean, that just shows that God's in control of his world. Now, I think all things are trying to get people to come to know him. Don't you know this is something like the plagues of Egypt? There's a lot of direct correspondence in quotes between what God did to the Egyptian and what God's going to do to the Philistines. God humiliated the Egyptian deities by means of the plagues. Here's a plague on the Philistines, and their deity is going to be humiliated too. I think God was trying to get the Egyptians' attention theologically, and I think God is trying to get the Philistines' attention theologically, because God loves Egyptians and Philistines. He loves his people too, but he loves his people, Israel, because they're supposed to be a kingdom of priests to bring all the world to God, and they're not doing that. And God has to show himself through judgment, and yet it's still a theological judgment. That in my opinion, by humiliating these idols, God is trying to say to these folks, listen up, I'm God. Don't you want to know me? I'm more powerful than Dagon. I'm more powerful than anybody, any god you know. I'm the God who acts. I have plagued you. Well, I think there's something to that. And I hope you see that in this lesson. Well, the death of Eli is a major turning point, as I've talked to you before. It's a foreshadowing of the transfer of the priesthood from the line of Eli to a new line of Levites. Eli's descendants are going to be in Abathar, which is one of the priests under David. And he was a very godly priest. He was the only priest that survived the slaughter at Nob when Saul killed everybody for helping David. But this Abathar is going to go with one of David's sons, Adonijah, that rebels against his father. And when David comes back in control, he's going to banish this priesthood by means of Solomon to the little town of Anathoth. And Zadok becomes priest. And that is what this is all about. Well, we're going to study chapters 6 and 7 next time. I've really enjoyed being with you. And I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.